Thank you, Joe. Thank you, Rhonda. Thank you very much, everybody, for the invitation to speak. Let me just get my watch here so I can see the magnitude by which I'm going to run over time shortly. Firstly, let me acknowledge the Minister, Senator Kay Patterson, the Parliamentary Secretary, Hong Lim, the Chair of our community, Carol Schwartz, the special guest speaker, Judy Rogers, and the many mayors and community leaders that are here. I guess I knew I was back in Australia when I heard that wonderful phrase, ladies and gentlemen. It's good to be home. Now, it used to be said that in polite society, you don't mention either politics or religion. Unfortunately, today I'm going to mention both. Rhonda and Dennis asked me to imagine a future with communities in control, which I have. But to talk about it, I'll make frequent references to both economics and morality, so my apologies in advance. I might also say, though, that I was touched by the story the Minister just told of her own background, and I wanted to add a couple of things from my background that I think are relevant to this group. I grew up in a single-parent family with four kids on the Deserted Wives Pension on the central coast of New South Wales. As the only male in the family, it was the opportunity to interact in community organisations, in my case my church and my table tennis club, that provided the alternative role models that were a really important part of my life becoming something that that has thus far worked out reasonably well. So as the Minister herself said, you never know who you touch in the work that you do. And hopefully one day many of the people you're working with will be in similar situations thanking you, albeit potentially at a distance. I come here both to encourage you and to challenge you. We know that community organisations make a huge contribution to the nation, but we're not always sure how to measure it. We know that investing in people pays huge dividends, but we can't say which investments are the best. We know that the earlier we ensure a child has access to a positive, nurturing, learning environment, the greater their life chances. We know that adolescents need access to non-parental role models, and that sporting and community organisations are often where they find them. We know that even in old age, without community involvement, our elderly experience higher incidence of dementia and longer periods of expensive aged care. In short, we know intuitively that investing in people can be a very good investment. It's what economists call human capital. But we have very little capacity to measure it, and it's often unclear which of these investments in people create the best results and which are a bit ordinary or even negative. And I think the reference the Minister made to the trials in Canada to try and find ways of benchmarking that are a valuable start. Similarly, we know that investing in our communities is vitally important. We know that without our sporting organisations, our health costs would rise dramatically. We know that without our arts organisations, we'd pay a higher price in intolerance and misunderstanding. We know that if we don't change the worst of our environmental practices, the costs in the future will be massive. We know that neighbourhoods that are renewed and vital have lower crime and health costs. Social capital, as it's now called, is also valuable. We're just not sure how much and which things add the most to it and which the least. So much of what we do in community organisations adds to our society's stock of human capital and social capital, if you'll excuse my iconocratic language. But unless these contributions are recognised, measured and valued, we risk diminishing their role, moving away from a world where communities are in control to one where communities are at the margins. I want to address that threat. But to do that requires us to challenge some of the prevailing orthodoxies of economics, morality, and the community sector itself. Specifically, I want to challenge several things. Firstly, an economic view that says that our current debt-funded, consumption-driven economy is either preferable or sustainable. I don't believe it is. And further, the underlying premise that there is a fundamental conflict between a strong economy and a fair society, which is a premise that I would reject. And secondly, I want to challenge a moral worldview that sees the role of government as one of playing God, to reward and to punish, and which increasingly sees the role of the community sector as a mechanism through which these values are given effect. I believe that all of these things are both dangerous and wrong. As a consequence, I'd like to propose an alternative perspective. It looks a bit like this. Firstly, our economy is under serious threat from a combination of imbalances. Secondly, that in the modern world, far from there being a conflict, There is no path to a strong economy other than through a fair society. And thirdly, that this perspective creates a far more central role for community organisations in both our society and our economy. But for this to be realised will require radical changes in how governments measure outcomes and how they structure their relationships with community organisations. Most people I know don't need much persuading that we've become a less fair society in the last 20 years, even if we have become, on average at least, a more prosperous one. This seems to be an implied trade-off, that you can't have a strong economy if you want a fair society. My first concern is that I don't actually think the economy is anywhere near as strong as we've been told it is. And my second concern is that I don't believe we can have a strong economy without a fair society. So what's wrong with our economy? Well, at least four things. Four really big things, actually. Unemployment, household debt, the national debt, and a lack of competitive export industries. Now, I won't go into all of this in depth because it's not the prime purpose of my discussion, but let me briefly talk about what I mean on each of those. As many of you will know, our real unemployment rate is nowhere near 5%. The numbers are a fraud. If you add up the total of unemployment, disability, and sole parent benefits together, there are more people now than when the official unemployment rate was much, much higher. This despite over a decade of boom. We used to have 1 million unemployed and 100,000 disability pensions. Now we've got 500,000 unemployed and 600,000 disability pensions. Did I miss anything? We've just rearranged the deck chairs. That's why we still have 1 in 6 children growing up in a jobless household. This is before we get into the fact that if you work an hour a week, you're no longer unemployed, apparently. But surely, some will say, we have skill shortages. We have employers everywhere that can't fill their jobs. Well, believe it or not, that's also true. Because the skill levels and geographic locations of the unemployed don't match the jobs available. We have unemployed timber workers, but a shortage of mining engineers. We have unemployed textile workers, but a shortage of bricklayers. We have large pools of unemployed people living in our urban fringes, and shortages of fruit pickers in the Riverina. Because we haven't invested in skills and infrastructure, we now have the splendid idiocy of high real unemployment rates and skill shortages. We can debate the unemployment statistics if we must, but what nobody would debate is that come the next recession, unemployment, however you measure it, will double. It always does. So I guess we better pray we don't have another recession. Apparently, we've got the fastest growing economy in the OECD. Curiously, we've had the fastest growing level of consumer debt as well. We've had the best party on the block because we borrowed the most money to buy the most beer. As a nation, we should have been saving to invest, but instead we've been borrowing to consume. People are now spending a bigger part of their incomes paying off debt than they ever have, even more than when interest rates were at 17%. Why? Because we've got interest rates that are 2.5 times lower, we decided to borrow 3 times as much money. That may be okay so long as interest rates remain at 50-year lows forever, but that seems unlikely. Which brings us to our third problem, our trading position in the nation's debt. For the rest of Australian history, you could pretty much rely on one constant. When commodity prices were at the top, the nation ran a surplus, and when they were down, we ran a deficit. But now it's different. We're spending $1.07 overseas for every dollar we make, and yet our commodity prices are at 30-year highs. That's right, we're at the top of the price cycle, and yet we're already down the toilet on the trade balance. So what do we do when those prices go down again? If we had some fast-growing export industries outside mining to compensate, we might get out of the jam. But unfortunately, these are few and far between. So that's why I'm worried about the economy. I'm worried about its impact on unemployment, and I'm worried about the budgetary consequences of that for the community sector. And I'm also a bit peeved that we've dropped our commitment to a fair society while chasing what may have been an illusion of a strong economy. Most of the commentary from politicians and the media these days promotes the idea that there's an inherent conflict between the two. I disagree. Let me explain why a strong economy and a fair society are actually two sides of the same coin. You can't have one without the other. Let's start with the fairness side. We fall at the first hurdle if we don't have a strong economy. One word proof of that, unemployment. We know the devastating effects unemployment has on individuals, their families, and their neighbourhoods. Unemployment drives poor outcomes on every other social indicator, health, crime, educational attainment, or anything else. That makes the need for a stronger a strong economy, an absolute must for anyone who's passionate about a fair society. We also know that when economies head south, poverty increases, funding for community organisations and the welfare safety net gets squeezed, and all the capital investments in schools and hospitals tend to get put on hold. There's nothing pretty about a bad economy, especially for disadvantaged people. So I hope that you'll agree that a strong economy is a critical component of creating a fair society. But now perhaps a more contentious argument, that a fair society is an essential building block for a strong economy. The global economy is now a team sport, and if we don't put the strongest team we've got on the paddock, we're letting ourselves down. That means investing in our people rather than fighting among ourselves. If you visit your local bookshop, look in the business and management section. All the action is around topics like branding, intellectual property, knowledge management, human resource development, innovation and such like. What the accountants would call the intangible assets on the balance sheet. It's the investments in people, their ideas and their relationships that drive value in modern capitalism. These same lessons can be applied to society and the economy as a whole. I'd like to give four examples to illustrate this proposition. Early childhood intervention programs, education, fertility and wages. Since we're talking about investments, let's talk briefly about rates of return. With most traditional investments like shares or property or bonds, rates of return are usually in the range of 7 to 12% per annum over the long term. So keep in mind this basic calibration when I get into a few other numbers. 5% is kind of a small number, 10% is a pretty good number, 15% or above is an absolute Monty. Now let's look at some traditional fair society priorities. And as we do, let's look not as we normally do from the point of view of fairness and equity, but rather in cold hard terms of rates of return and economics. You may be surprised by the outcome. James Heckman, a Nobel Prize winning economist, quotes the Perry Preschool Study, with which some of you may be familiar, where two groups of severely disadvantaged children in Chicago were split. One received a high quality preschool program designed to overcome the symptoms of their disadvantage. The other group didn't. They were the control group. They followed these kids for 25 years through to adulthood and to keep track of the differences. The results were startling. Perry study participants outflanked their control group peers across the board. They were much more likely to complete high school. They were over four times more likely to earn a decent income, three times more likely to own their own home, more than twice as likely to never be a welfare recipient, and almost half as likely to ever get arrested. So this is a great result for creating a fair society, at least if you were lucky enough to get access to the program. But let's look at the economics of these outcomes. That's what's really startling. When you measure the benefits of higher incomes and lower costs, the investment in these kids resulted in a rate of return of about 16% compound per annum. 16%. Remember what we said about property, shares and bonds returning 7 to 12%? Remember we said 15% and above was a Monty in anyone's language? Well, here we are, investing in disadvantaged kids and generating a return of 16% per annum. Now that looks like a fair society and a strong economy to me. Now let's look at education. Gary Becker, another Nobel Prize winning economist, first published a book called Human Capital in 1964. He quotes studies that show the rate of return on an individual's investment in education varied from 16% to 28% for completing high school and between 12% and 15% for university. Again, these are outstanding returns on investment in anyone's language. 5% if you stick it in the bank, 7 to 12% for shares or property, and 12 to 28% if you invested in education. Mark Blaug from the University of London quotes from several studies into the economics of education. These measured the rates of return to society from investments in education. And they are estimated between 7% and 20% in one study and 11% to 37% in another. Another bonanza. Now I'd like to read a rather long quote, and I apologise in advance for that, from a very eminent economist that highlights the importance of investing in everyone's education, not just a privileged few. At the end I'll tell you who said this and you may be a little surprised. You'll see I'm quoting a phalanx of right-wing economists to make an argument for a fair society here. And I quote, "For the past 20 years, the real incomes of skilled, especially highly skilled workers, have risen more than the average for all workers. whereas real wage rate increases for lesser skilled workers have been below average, virtually non-existent. This difference in wage trends suggests that we have developed a shortage of highly skilled workers and a surplus of lesser skilled workers. This has the potential to hamper the adjustment flexibility of our economy overall. We've placed much greater emphasis on the need to provide equality of opportunity than on equality of outcomes. But equal opportunity requires equal access to knowledge. We need to pursue equal access to knowledge to ensure that our economic system works at maximum efficiency and that it's perceived to be just in its distribution of rewards. In other words, this economist is saying that by leaving people behind, by not investing in the education and training of as many as possible, we are limiting the growth and limiting the flexibility of our economy. So who is this economic advocate for a fairer society? None other than the chairman of the US Federal Reserve, the equivalent of our Reserve Bank, Alan Greenspan. So I hope that this blizzard of numbers and Nobel Prize winners was compelling. Let me try a different example that just makes common sense. We're constantly reminded that our declining fertility levels and consequent ageing population is a recipe for economic hard times. And I'm sure it is. But while Peter Costello is smugly suggesting that we have one for the husband, one for the wife, and one for the nation, let's have a quick think about why people are not actually doing that. Well, let's see. We've got housing affordability for young people at its worst levels in 20 years. They've got huge and rising HECS debts, which they didn't used to have. And if the women dare contemplate the fact that 50% of marriages end in divorce, and that this is more likely than not to plunge her and her children into poverty, and increasingly into becoming the objects of blame by people like Costello, well, I just can't figure out why people aren't having one for the nation, can you? Finally, let's talk about wages. Some people would have you believe that high wage levels hamper international competitiveness. I think that's the usual rhetoric. Yet Austrade's chief economist, Tim Harcourt, tells us that manufacturing exporters pay 40% higher wages than companies of the same size in the same business that focus on the domestic market. They have to play in the global A grade, you have to compete smart as well as hard. So the people that are most internationally competitive are paying the higher wages, not the lower. It seems that far from being a barrier to international competitiveness, higher wages are a consequence of it. So I hope that many of you will agree that these examples show that there is no conflict between a strong economy and a fair society. So why do so many believe that there is? I think it's because this falsehood is perpetrated with two very effective tools, a punitive morality code and a dodgy accounting system. Let me take you through each. It used to be said that the conservative side of politics was interested in wealth creation and the progressive side only in wealth distribution. Maybe that was true once. If so, it certainly isn't now. Given what we've just discussed about the greatest wealth being generated by investing in the greatest number of people, this old debate has been turned upside down. The fairness position is now the one concerned with maximising wealth by investing in the maximum number of people to the maximum extent. The debate over distribution is now the province of conservatives, particularly when it comes to debates about public versus private provision. Rather than worry about our team's capacity to compete in the global A grade by skilling up all our players to the maximum of their ability, this position is all about fighting among ourselves as to how we'll distribute the spoils, even if it's at the expense of the team's success. Why would you do that? Well, let me tell you, it has nothing to do with economics. It has a lot to do with a worldview that uses punitive morality as an excuse for redistribution. If I can convince people that you are a bad person, and then I can convince them to take resources away from you and give them to me, if I am a good person. Take money from those evil single mums and give it to us good, hard-working, six-figure salary types. Take money from those evil, slovenly, under-resourced schools and give it to the well-funded, over-resourced schools that people clearly want more. All the better if I can find 1 or 2% of people in any group that really aren't pulling their weight. And sadly, there'll always be a few of those. Because then you can highlight that tiny minority to vilify the entire group. That creates a climate where we can redistribute away from them all. For example, sadly, when official unemployment does start to rise again, we'll have a resurgence of blaming the unemployed for their plight. You know the routine, they say, these people are unemployed because they're bludgers, their own immorality has put them there. and then they'll parade some unfortunate illustrative example on tabloid TV. The funny thing about the immorality of unemployment is that we seem to have sudden outbreaks of mass immorality at almost exactly the same time that we have slowdowns in our economy. You can pretty much set your watch by it. Don't get me wrong, there'll always be a few people who aren't serious about getting a job, no matter how good the economy is, but that's probably less than 1%. It's just that the number of those people doesn't change. Changes in unemployment are a result of the economy, not epidemics of immorality. So you can see the usefulness of this punitive morality code in covering the tracks of redistribution in the guise of what's good for the economy. Morality is used as a smokescreen to justify redistribution. It's not about the size of the pie, it's about grabbing a bigger piece of it, even at the expense of the economy as a whole. Of course, no one has a monopoly on morality. I'm certainly not here to speak on behalf of the Brotherhood, but I think everyone I know there would share my view that we see morality in working to give everyone a chance at maximising their potential. Perhaps that's what Jesus meant when he offered life and life more abundantly. The morality of punishment and rewards seems strangely out of place to us. Not content with morality as a shield, let's also look at the inadequacies of accounting and economics to show how we can fiddle the books to argue for redistribution rather than wealth creation. I want to talk about something economists rather politely call externalities. These are things that definitely have value, but which we either find difficult to measure or choose to leave out. Some are good, some are bad. For example, this is a bit cliched, but let's imagine a company pumps devastating pollution into a river for 50 years, destroying that river and its environment, without ever paying a cent in costs. The company's books may say it's a profitable enterprise, but if the lost value of the river, the agriculture on the land around it, the increased health costs to other river users and other such things were included, the real economics of this business may be a very large loss. By externalising these costs, by keeping them off the books, this company has created what economists call negative externalities and managed to show a profit. Similarly, what is the cost of a bank or a post office closing in a rural town? Is it more than just the redundancy payments to the staff? And who bears those extra costs? This is a discussion about externalities. Now, not all externalities are negative. When a preschool program delivers the sort of benefits we saw in the Perry study before, then it's created massive positive externalities, huge economic benefits that it doesn't keep for itself or count in its accounts. But those benefits are no less real because they're not counted or accounted for. Let me also say, lest I be inadvertently feeding any anti-business sentiment in this room, that there are many positive externalities that also flow from many businesses. The most obvious, but certainly not the only one, being the creation of new jobs, which has a value much greater than simply what those people are paid. There are massive positive externalities in job creation that businesses should get credit for, but don't. So what we have here is just poor accounting, leading to poor economics. Curiously enough, many of the uncounted positive externalities, like the valuable and vital role of volunteers in many of your organisations, or the value of creating jobs, are those parts that make up a fair society. Now, externalities are gradually being rooted out and accounted for by economists, but the job is far from complete. That's why new solutions like carbon credits trading come from, attempts to capture the real costs and benefits within one set of accounts. So until we're more accurate in measuring the benefits of a civil society and the problems created elsewhere, we'll be far from accurate in measuring and then promoting the fastest levels of economic growth and the strongest wealth creation. So there you have it. Two very clever tools to help justify redistribution in the name of a strong economy that actually have nothing to do with a strong economy. A punitive morality code and a dodgy accounting system. We have to see through both these devices if we want clarity about what really creates a fair society and consequently a really strong economy. So if you share my concerns about how we should see our economy and what our guiding values should be, then let me suggest some concrete things that you can do to move us in another direction. Perhaps the most challenging thing is for us to try and find ways to measure the impact of what we do, of what works and of what doesn't work. Because despite everything I've said, all social spending is not a social investment. Some works, some doesn't. In my ideal world, major government bodies like the Australian Bureau of Statistics would ultimately have a larger role in creating tools to help us do this systematically. while other organs of government would have a correspondingly smaller role, I might say. But in the meantime, we owe it to ourselves to try and find ways of measuring what's working and what isn't, keeping track of the people we work with, seeing how and if their lives are better off than those we haven't helped, measuring one approach versus another and benchmarking with sister organisations are all ways of getting some way down the path of measuring both the costs and the returns of our social investments, our investments in people and communities. Perhaps as important is just a way of thinking, of always asking yourself, is what we're doing making a long-term difference in people's lives? And if so, how could we quantify it? And how could we measure which parts are the most effective and which are the least? That's a big part of your role at the centre of an investing society. There are a few people left in the community sector now who haven't signed on for the notion that financial responsibility is a basic requirement to making an ongoing contribution. Both for your own organisation and for wider society, I hope that I've added to that further today with a view about why we should care about a strong economy and its capacity to help us deliver a fair society. But for many community sector organisations, particularly in the welfare sector, there's pressure in a different direction. That is the increasing tendency to become the service delivery arm of government. In some cases, this may be a good thing, but for others, I'd counsel caution. This creates very significant threats to your independence. It sets community organisations in competition with each other, often creating margin-squeezing exercises that mean that other operations or even bequests become cross-subsidisers of government programs. Now, where's the sense in that? It gets harder to exit when the terms become unfair because of concerns about what happens to your staff. Some others see an opportunity to make a substantial profit from their government operations, but do so by applying the government's punitive morality agenda to the greatest extent. The harder you punish the unemployed, the more corners you cut in aged care, the more money you can make. Then you can bid for more and more government work and build your market share. It sure builds your empire, but where does it leave your commitment to community? And when you become dependent, where does that leave your independence? The third thing I wanted to suggest is that we must speak up loudly about efforts to silence dissent. For a marketplace in ideas to be effective, there's got to be a diversity of views. For a civil society to operate, there's got to be a fabric of institutions that keep each other honest. Governments, media, companies, churches, universities, courts, unions and community organisations are all vital to a functioning democracy. But what we're currently witnessing is a systematic effort to quieten any dissent across a staggering range of these organisations. We have threats to the ability of community organisations to voice dissent without losing their tax-free status. We have threats of corporate defamation actions against environmental and consumer organisations. We have a massive attack on the union movement. We have the board of the ABC being stacked with opinionated partisans. We have funding for student organisations about to be decimated, and we'll shortly have a consolidation of corporate media ownership. The first priority in response to this is unity among the community sector, a clear understanding that an attack on one is an attack on all, at least when it comes to the ability to speak out. Changing our understanding of economics, questioning our moral frameworks, and making practical changes to our approach to running community organisations are all part of a shift to a world where communities are truly in control. I like to imagine what our country would look like if we take these issues seriously. If we have a vision of an investing society, or in Maslowian terms, a self-actualised nation. One that is fully invested in early childhood development, fully invested in education and training, fully invested in creating and retaining vibrant, healthy communities, export-oriented and globally competitive in its economy, and focused first on creating the wealth that education and technology can bring, rather than fighting among ourselves over distributing the proceeds. I think it's possible to imagine that alternative future. I can imagine a world where we understand and fully value the benefits of investing in our people, where we have ways of measuring what works and what doesn't, so we can focus our social spending on the most effective investments in our people. Where the local school becomes not a minimalist education facility offering an ever-diminishing range of options to an ever-diminishing number of students, but rather it becomes the centre of its community. Where the school facilities are shared by a wide range of community organisations, and where they return the favour by offering a wide range of extracurricular activities to the kids. where those parents can now enjoy their kids getting a 9-to-5 education with the richness of experience found in expensive private schools. And the community sees the school as the nerve centre of its commitment to its young people and the meeting place for all. I can imagine a world where economic externalities, positive and negative, are fully accounted for and valued. It's not a triple bottom line world, it's a single bottom line. But that single bottom line correctly attributes all social costs and all social benefits, where social credits can be created and distributed by an efficient market, a logical extension of the carbon trading credits experiment that's starting now, where corporations and community organisations can then deal directly with each other if they wish, without the need for government intermediation, and can deal among themselves to ensure the most efficient distribution of social benefits and the full accounting of social costs. This is not a world that opposes markets. It's one that uses them to the full. It's not a world opposed to financial accountability. It's one committed to the full and accurate accounting for all the value that's created and destroyed. This is not a world that spends on fairness with no thought for tomorrow. It's one that understands the critical role of fairness in creating a strong economy and knits the two together in a single bottom line. It's a world where the best community practice or best practice community organisations can prove their value, the value of their contribution, and be recognised for it. It separates real long-term outcomes from short-term feel-goods. It's a world that focuses first on maximising wealth and economic value and distributes it fairly because the value is created by investments in the people and the communities themselves. It's a world that rejects a punitive morality that is an excuse for redistribution and replaces it with an inclusive morality that sees human potential as the thing to maximise. It treats the tiny number who refuse to help themselves as the exception, not the rule. It's a world where communities are in control. They're vibrant and connected at the local level. They're valued and funded through an efficient market at the national level. And we set the example for the rest of the world to follow at the global level. It's a world where the strongest economy is driven by the fairest society. I hope today's discussion has shone some light on the central role that each of you can play in creating that world.